shop on the corner in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania?
Probably. Oh, no, I don't know it. All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome back to Torah Studies. This is our weekly foray, into the soul of the Torah portion. We are live in our new cafe space, Chabad cafe space on the Beltline. This is wonderful. We're in Jeff's place. Classes, dedicating all the classes in memory and honor of Jeff Moshe Kraus. And today we talk about inspiration. So apparently, I've been told, you guys can confirm it for me, I'm not an expert in this field, but apparently there is a new year coming up. Is this true? A new calendar year approaching, so they say, in a few weeks. What are we, December?
Sometimes around every 12 months.
Every 12 months or so. So today is December 12, right? So we have another 18 or 19 days until January 1st. Now, which is always awkward, because January 1st, suddenly you have to sign your checks, right? 2019. I just got used to 5779, and then I'm here all week. Literally, this is where I hang out. So, okay, so the 9 and the 9, it makes it easier, yes. So now, here we go. So New Year's is infamous for New Year's resolutions, right? Everyone, New Year's resolution, and you pledge to do something, and then within 2 weeks, it's done, right? Within 2 weeks, resolution is finished. In fact, 87% of New Year's resolutions are already broken within the first few months. That's a stat that I just made up myself. So, no, but there's something upwards of 80 to 90% of New Year's resolutions are, I made up the specific number I made up, but something like that, there's a very large percentage of I'm waving to people on Facebook. Hi, Lisa. So there's a large percentage of New Year's resolutions that don't make it. And the question is, why? What goes wrong? Why is it that you and I can be inspired and decide that this is what we're doing and this is how we're doing it, and etc. And then, shortly thereafter, it's like it never happened. The inspiration goes, it disappears, it dissipates, and it's like it never was. No trace of that inspiration left behind. What is at the core of those things that challenge, that serve to kind of derail our inspiration? In other words, two questions we're asking is, number one, what goes wrong? We were inspired. We had a good idea. What happened? What went wrong, number one? And number two, what can we do about it to ensure that we don't fall into that trap of making resolutions or getting inspired and it not panning out? That's the core discussion tonight. And tonight, we look in a very unlikely source. When I say unlikely, I mean for this topic directly, it's not going to be super intuitive to immediately see the connection between the Torah story that we'll explore and this topic. But by the end of the class, hopefully, the goal is to bring everything back and to make sense of it all and to weave it all back together again. The story we're going to focus on is the inspirational, the heartwarming, tear-jerking reunion of Joseph and his brothers, but especially his father. So, if you've been paying attention for the last few weeks in the Torah, so we've been exploring the drama of Joseph HaTzadik. And Yosef HaTzadik, Joseph is sold as a slave. He ends up in Egypt. He is successful, but then he gets thrown into prison. He gets out of prison. He becomes viceroy. He is second in command. The brothers come to Egypt to buy food. He recognizes them. They don't recognize him. He starts manipulating the situation in order to bring about a certain level of teshuvah, repentance. And ultimately, the brothers demonstrate that they are truly remorseful and have changed their ways from where they were prior with their conduct with him. And at that point, Yosef reveals his true identity to them. They are astonished. They don't know what to say. He says to them, Ani Yosef, Ha'or Avichai, I am Yosef, his father's still alive. And then after they get over their shock, he says, go quickly, back home, get father and the rest of the family and come down to Egypt because there's still a famine. We still have a number of years left for this to the famine, and there's plenty of food here for everyone. So let's pick this up inside. Please open up your chamashim to the Torah portion, which is Vayigash. You can find it in the good condition on page number 299. Thank you very much. 298 to 299. All right, Tim, I'll ask you to start reading, and I'll tell you where we should pick it up from. Please pick it up from page 301, actually. So the next page over, 301, chapter 45, please begin. Yosef reveals his identity.
Yosef couldn't bear the thought that all the Egyptians standing beside him would see his brother's shame when he revealed himself to them. So he called out, take everyone away from me. Thus no one stood with Yosef when he revealed himself to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians who had been sent out hurried. Soon, the whole of Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph, is my father still alive?
Okay, so perfect. So let's pause there for a second. So that was the big reveal. Ani Yosef Horavichaim, Yosef, his father still alive. Now turn the page. Let's continue. Turn the page. Skip a little bit to 303. Tim, please continue where verse number 9, where it says, hurry up, or hurry.
Hurry and go up to the land of Israel, to my father, and say to him, this is what your son Joseph said. God has made me a master over the Egyptians. Come down here to me. Do not delay. You can dwell in the land of Goshen, you, your children, your grandchildren, your flocks, your cattle, and everything that's yours, and you'll be near me. I will sustain you there, you, your household, and everything that's yours, so you don't become poor, for there are still 5 years of famine.
Perfect. Now skip a few paragraphs and go to verse 14. This is really important. So on the same page, the last paragraph, right before the next little title there, Yosef.
Yosef fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and cried, and Benjamin cried on his neck. He kissed all his brothers and cried over them. After his brothers saw that he was sincere, they spoke with him.
Okay, so here we go. Yosef falls on the shoulder, on the neck of his brother Benjamin, and Benjamin falls, Yosef cries on Benjamin's neck, and Benjamin cries on Yosef's neck. So they cry on each other's necks, and the commentators explain what they were crying about. But the important thing is here, for right now, that they cried on each other's necks. Let's continue. Now, Yaakov, the father, Jacob, is told about this, about his son being alive, and he begins his journey down. Now, take a look at, let's continue, page 300... Hold on, 300, wait, 311. 311, okay, 311, right at the top where it says he sent Yehuda.
He sent Yehuda ahead of him to Yosef to direct him to Goshen. And they came to the land of Goshen.
So who's he? He is Jacob, Yaakov. Yaakov sends his son Yehuda ahead. So the entire family is now headed to Egypt. So Yehuda goes ahead to direct him to Goshen. And the understanding is that he was meant to open up a yeshiva, a Jewish school there. Fine. And then they come to the land of Goshen. Goshen was a district in Egypt that was considered to be a good quality district, a good place to live. Let's continue. This is the key verse of the whole class. Take it away.
Yosef harnessed his chariot, and he went up to Goshen to meet Israel, his father. When Yosef appeared before his father, he fell on his neck, and he wept on his neck profusely.
Who fell on whose neck, and who wept on his neck profusely? Tell me what happened. Who in the context of this verse, who fell on the other's neck and cried? Who was it? Yosef, right? Yosef harnessed his chariot. He went up to Goshen to meet his father. When Yosef appeared before his father, he, Yosef, fell on his neck, his father's neck, and he, Yosef, wept on his father's neck profusely. When it came to Binyamin, they both cried on each other's necks. Remember? Right, they both cried on each other's necks. When it comes to Yosef and Yaakov, his father, only Yosef is doing the crying. The crying is a one-way street. What's Yaakov doing? Yaakov is stoic. He's not crying. The question is asked, and all the commentaries address this. Why? It's not like the Torah doesn't comment when two people are crying. It just did a few pages before. Yosef and Binyamin, the two brothers, they're crying on each other's necks. Both were crying. When it comes to the reunion, after 22 years, remember this, 22 years of separation, it says that Yaakov was forever mourning his son. He never forgot his son. He always had this pain of this loss, of this separation, whatever it was, for Yosef. He always held that hope on some level for Yosef. And now he's reunited. What happens? Only Yosef is crying. Yaakov is not crying. Why isn't Yaakov crying? So Rashi explains. What do you have?
Well, I would think that you let me all these years, you let me think that my brother was dead.
My son, you mean my son? Yeah. So maybe he harbored a little bit of, okay, that could be. I haven't seen that angle being taken, but I hear what you're saying. Rashi gives a very interesting interpretation that, in fact, in my opinion, raises more questions than answers. Take a look. Ray, please read Rashi's explanation. Rashi, but we need to look into the Torah Studies booklets, the copies. You got a copy? Open it up, please. To page number 204. This is the key interpretation. 204. Rashi explains why it is that the crying was a one-way street.
You want 2B?
2B. Or not 2B. Joking. 2B.
And he appeared to him. Joseph presented himself to his father, and he wept on his neck for a long time. The verse uses an expression of profuse weeping. Jacob, however, neither fell on Joseph's neck nor kissed him. Our sages said that he was reciting the Shema.
What? Okay, before I ask the questions, Rashi says that at the time of the reunion of father and son, after 22 years, incredible agony and emotion on both sides, when they finally embrace, only Yosef is doing the neck falling, the falling on his neck, and only Yosef is doing the crying. Why? What was Yaakov doing?
Stop it.
Yaakov was praying, he was saying Shema. Can you imagine? Now,
it's so unlike Rashi.
I have to explain. So when you say Shema, you're not supposed to be distracted by anything else, right? When you say Shema, you should be focused. Certain prayers, you can talk in between the prayers. But certain prayers, you're not allowed to utter any other word in between, and you can't interrupt it at all, like the Amidah, the Shemoneh Esrei. Shema, you can't interrupt. So certain prayers, you're not supposed to create an interruption. So Rashi says, why didn't Yaakov cry? Why didn't he put his head on, rest his head on Yosef's neck? He was in the middle of saying Shema. But still, a person could ask, are you kidding me? After 22 years? Fine if you're really into Shema typically. But imagine your child. Imagine your beloved child after 22 years. You finally see him. Are you not going to somehow acknowledge him even in the middle of Shema? So for that we could say, to that we might answer, and we have a text for this, text 3a. We might say that, you know what, Yaakov was a very, very holy person. And if for you and I, we're not supposed to have casual interruptions in the middle of our prayers, a prayer of the Shema. For Yaakov, even his son, his beloved son, he wouldn't interrupt in the middle of his prayers because he was so attuned to what God wanted that he wouldn't interrupt it. Take a look at text 3a. Julian, please read text 3a, page 205.
Patriarchs were truly the divine
chariot,
as the verse states, and God went up from above Abraham. Another verse states, and God went up from him. Another verse states, and behold, God was standing over him.
Okay, so let's leave the verses aside and the proof aside. The point of the Midrash is it says that Ha'avot, the patriarchs, Hain Hamarkava, they were indeed the divine chariot. What does that mean for us? The Alter Rebbe explains in text 3b. Please continue, Jillian, one more. 205.
This is what the sages meant when they said, the patriarchs are truly the divine chariot. All their organs were completely holy and detached from mundane matters. And throughout their lives, they served as a vehicle for nothing but the divine will.
The Alter Rebbe explains like this. What is a chariot in modern times? It would be called a vehicle. What is a vehicle? A vehicle is some... Well, it depends which vehicle you're driving. Because sometimes a vehicle couldn't have a mind of its own. But a good vehicle is something that doesn't do anything on its own without being guided by you. You're the driver. You tell it where to go, when to go, how fast to go. You're in control. It doesn't have a will, a desire, an agenda of its own. Again, a good car doesn't have its own agenda. A broken down car says, you know what? We're going to stop right now. But I have to... No, we're really going to stop right now. It's not happening. Hey, you got to pull off the side of the road because I'm done. That's a car that needs repair. But a good car, a true vehicle, is an automobile or a thing that doesn't have its own will. It doesn't have its own agenda. It's purely channeling the will and desire of the driver. So our sages say, Ha'avot, the patriarchs and the matriarchs, Hein Merkava, they were the divine chariot. In other words, they were completely transparent to what God wanted. They knew what God wanted, and they moved to the flow of the divine energy. They didn't have their own agenda. So you can imagine someone like this. Someone like a patriarch, right? Someone like a Jacob, who was a patriarch, one of the three patriarchs. So Jacob, when reciting the Shema, it wasn't even him. He didn't have his own agenda. He was totally channeling God's presence. He was totally connected with God and communing with God at that time. So you can imagine that if you're Jacob, you might not have even seen your son, Yosef, even after 22 years at that moment, because all you're experiencing is what?
Prayer.
It's God and prayer at that moment. So now we might answer the question, how is it that Yaakov, the father, didn't weep on his neck, didn't fall on Yosef's neck, didn't weep, didn't cry out of tears of joy or whatever, reunion or sadness, whatever it was? Why? Because he was saying the Shema. But he was a chariot, and chariots don't cry. Title of my new book, Chariots Don't Cry. Kidding, but it sounds like either a book or a band. Now, is this a good answer? Does it make sense? What's your question? We got to have questions. This is not a good answer, yeah.
Well, I was wondering that there was a little bit of folderol about, there was some commotion about Yosef coming.
Right.
And that Yaakov might have known a little bit about him. He's coming. Don't get into the Shema.
Sarah asked $1 million question. That's exactly my question. It's all nice and fine. It all makes sense if you posit that he was saying Shema at that moment. But the question is, why did he have to choose that moment to say Shema? What, he couldn't have timed it? I mean, how long is Shema? Even if you say it with intent. I don't know. I mean, people can knock off a Shema in like 2 minutes. 90 seconds, 2 minutes. You go really slow. 5 minutes. 6 minutes. I mean, he had 22 years to say Shema. I'm kidding. But he had a whole day. He could have said it before. He could have said it after. Are you telling me that the only time he could have said it was at this moment, Dan?
I was thinking that Jacob might have been angry because his son didn't contact him for 22 years.
That was what was mentioned, right. That's what Ray mentioned, that maybe there was a little bit of holding back. But that's a different approach. I haven't seen that in the commentaries. I'm not saying it's not there. It might be discussed in some commentaries, but that's a very different angle than the one that Rashi takes and the one that we're trying to figure out.
But it's a normal human response.
I understand that, but according to Rashi, it was not the emotional. It was not any misgivings on the part of Yaakov. It was straight up saying Shema. And my question is, on Rashi, given fine, Yaakov is a divine chariot and Shema is on a very powerful level. But why choose that moment to say Shema? Mike?
I wouldn't ask the question.
Oh, what do you have?
Because he was laser focused.
Come on. But why is he saying Shema? What are the odds? What are the odds that that moment should be the time for Shema? You have a window for Shema. Okay, they didn't travel that fast. Hold on. One second. He wasn't like, beam me up, Scotty. That's not what happened, right? He could have seen Yosef from a distance approaching, right? He would have known.
Especially in a big fancy
chair. Why didn't he wait?
Well, maybe he didn't wait. Maybe he was saying it then on purpose.
Oh, now you're talking. Good. The question is, why did he choose that moment to say Shema?
But did he? I mean, Rashi doesn't.
Rashi doesn't say that. But again,
our sages
tell us, right? The Talmud and the Midrash, they all tell us.
Of everything he'd been working for, hoping for.
See how much Joseph was
dominating for.
Okay, good. Good. We have good ideas. Yeah.
Maybe he was acknowledging the Hashkaka prophet.
Good, you're touching on what the Maharal says. We're going to go, all of these are great ideas. We're going to have one more piece that really frames it in a powerful way and brings it back for a lesson of the week that you and I can take home. But first, I want to take you into a dramatic moment in the ancient yeshiva in Yavne. Do you remember the yeshiva in Yavne 2,000 years ago? Here's what happened. A lot of you may know this story. The reason why I'm asking is, okay, remember when the second temple, again, when I say remember, it's not like you and I were there, but so the Talmud tells us the story of the temple's destruction, second temple, by the Romans. And it says the Romans were approaching, they had besieged the city, and things were getting bad, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was one of the great leaders of the time, smuggled himself out of the city in a coffin, exactly, faked his own death, smuggled himself out, went to Vespasian, spelled Vespasian, but according to the historians that I know, it's Vespasian. He went to Vespasian's tent, who was the general of the Roman army, and he called him your majesty, and he said, I'm not the king. And at that moment, a messenger from Rome came and said that the emperor had died and he was appointed. He's like, whoa, that's pretty good. So he's like, okay, I'll give you whatever you want. I'll grant your request. Why are you here? So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, okay, I have a few requests. There were three requests. I'll leave the first two aside. He said one of the requests, I don't remember which order it was, one of the requests is, 10 Yavne v'chachameha. When you destroy Israel, leave the city of Yavne and the sages to have a place to study and study Torah, and people to study Torah, scholars to teach Torah, and for Judaism to continue post-temple. He was a forward-thinking leader. At a time of crisis, he didn't just hold on to what was clearly being taken away and then allow everything to be destroyed. He was able to see what was going to happen, and he literally created a situation where there would be a tomorrow for Judaism, and because of his efforts, Judaism flourishes till this very day in the four walls of Torah study and the many temples that we build and synagogues and Bate Midrashim and study halls around the world. Fine. So the yeshiva, after Jerusalem fell, the yeshiva continued in Yavne for decades. The story goes, after Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the next head of the yeshiva was a rabbi by the name of Rabban Gamliel. He was a very great scholar, but he was a very strict individual. He was so strict that people were not happy with him. And the story goes that at one point in time, they actually got rid of him. They replaced him with somebody much younger, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is famous in the Haggadah for saying, I am like 70 years old. You know the story, he says, I'm like 70 years old. He wasn't 70, he was like 17 or 18, whatever it was, but he overnight, he grew white hairs, and he looked older than he was, but he was a young person who had been put into the position of leadership of the yeshiva. And immediately he implemented changes that people loved. One of the changes was the following. Rabbi Gamliel, who was the old head of the yeshiva, the academy, he had a rule that said, if you want to show up to study, you have to be not only someone who studies, who puts on the appearance of studying Torah, but you have to have internalized it. In other words, you have to not only talk the talk, but walk the walk. And he said, if your inside is not like your outside, I mean, you might seem like a Torah scholar, but how are you inside? What's your spiritual purity inside? And if you're not spiritually pure on the inside, then you can't come into the yeshiva. So he had bouncers. This is a very unique type of bouncer. I don't know what their test was. I know there's usually a list and then they kind of size people up. But this spiritual bouncer, the yeshiva bouncer, was someone who, that's a great name for something, yeshiva bouncer. Anyway, the yeshiva bouncer was someone who knew whether somebody was kind of just, someone who studies on the outside but not genuine, or someone who was truly genuine on the inside. When Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah took over, he changed that. He said, it doesn't matter who you are. If you're ready to learn, the doors are open. We'll see what happens next. Take a look at text 4. Sarah, please read text 4. Talmud Tractate Brachot.
It was taught on that day that they removed Rabbi Gamliel from his position and appointed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah in his place. They dismissed the guard at the door and permission was granted for the students to enter. For Rabbi Gamliel used to proclaim and say, any student who's inside is not like his outside may not enter the study hall. On that day, several benches were added to the study hall to accommodate the numerous new students. Rabbi Yochanan said, Abba Yosef ben Dostai?
Yeah.
And the rabbis disputed this matter. One said 400 benches were added to the study hall, and one said 700 benches were added to the study hall.
That's a few benches. Right? It says several benches were added. Several, like 400 or 700. Right? So you had a lot of benches. In other words, there were a lot more students that came to the study hall. What happened, by the way, if you want to know the end of the story, end of the story is Rabbi Gamliel, who was the old head of the academy, so he came back to study like a regular student. He said, okay, I'm out of the head? Fine. I'm not going to like turn my nose on. I'm not going to get all offended and say, that's it, I'm out, I'm not coming back. No, the next day, he was out at the head, he came back like everyone else, and he studied in the academy in the back, one of the benches. And they were so impressed by his humility and his sincerity that they brought him back in, and they gave him back his position, ultimately. And they said, but they couldn't take away Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's position either, so they split it. Every month, they gave Rabbi Gamliel was the head. Again, he took over his old job. They gave Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah to be the head 1 month, 1 week per month. So 3 weeks was Rabbi Gamliel, and 1 week was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. But what's the point? The point is now we're seeing something interesting. There's a concept of tocho kebaro, inside like the outside. Rabbi Gamliel values sincerity. You have to be true in the inside. If you're walking the, well, I don't know what, walking or talking, whatever it is. If you're given the appearance of something, you should be genuine on the inside. The truth is, though, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's method is the one that's pretty much accepted. We don't hold people under a microscope, and we don't look at them with a fine, we don't sift through them with a, whatever it is, with a fine tooth comb. Somebody wants to do something good, we let it go. In fact, the Talmud also, a different part of the Talmud speaks of this truth. Take a look, Mike, please read text number 5.
Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, a person should always engage in Torah study and performance of mitzvot, even if he does so not for their own sake. For through the performance of mitzvot, not for their own sake, one comes to perform them for their own sake.
In other words, what he's saying is like this. Imagine a person is doing a mitzvah, but they're doing it for an agenda. They want to look like the guy who does a mitzvah. Or they're studying Torah because they want everyone to say about them, ooh, that person is so smart and so studious. So it's self-serving. The mitzvah is self-serving. The Torah study is self-serving. What does the Talmud say in Pesachim? A very un-Rabbi Gamliel statement. Rabbi Gamliel would say, if you're not genuine inside out, you have your own agenda. Self-serving. Nah, your inside is not pure. You're not welcome here. But what did Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah say? We're not going to look at your motives. We're not going to look inside. You're doing what you need to do. You're welcome to the academy. And that's what the Talmud says in text 5. The Talmud says, we always welcome somebody to do a mitzvah or to study Torah, even if it's not with pure intentions. Because if you're doing the right thing without pure intentions, ultimately you're going to come to a place to do it with pure intentions. That's the way it works. Mitach shaloi lishma, ba lishma. Do the good behavior. Give tzedakah because you want the recognition. But give tzedakah. Ultimately you'll give even for without the recognition. Train yourself to do the right thing, even if it's for ulterior motives. Ultimately you'll do it for the right reason.
We'll do what we will hear.
Exactly. The first thing is action. Get it done. Even when we put on tefillin. Right? There's the head, and then there's the hand. The head is like the intention, the hand is action. Which one goes on first? Action. First you do, and then you figure out, then you feel, then you think, and whatever. Okay, good. So what do we have here? We have this idea, this notion, that's the accepted notion, which is don't let your imperfections on the inside, don't let that hold you back from doing what you need to be doing on the outside. In other words, be a mensch, even though you don't feel like a mensch. Do the mitzvah, help someone else out, even though inside you're maybe kicking and screaming. Study Torah, even though maybe you want to do it for your own arrogance. It doesn't matter. Not that you shouldn't try to work on that stuff, but don't let the inside imperfections hold you back from doing the perfect actions on the outside. Good. But the reverse is also true. There's also a reverse condition. What's the reverse condition? That is, on the inside it is good, on the outside it's no good. Let me explain. So far we're talking about where the outside is good, the inside is not so perfect. And we said, don't worry about it, keep on doing it. But what about when the opposite is true? What about when the inside is in a good place, but the outside is not in a good place? So I'll give you an example. The Talmud talks about a situation where you have a thief, a ganav. Right? You know that, right? A thief. He's not only a thief. No, I'm sorry. He is a thief. Not a robber. He's a thief. The difference between a robber and a thief? I don't know if it works in English. Does it? What's a robber and what's a thief?
One has a weapon and holds you in the intent.
Sticks you up. Yeah.
Which one?
The robber.
So the way it's described... Right. The way it's described in Jewish law is like this. A robber is someone who brazenly, in the open, robs you. A thief is someone who's trying not to get, who breaks in stealthily at night or whatever it is, and tries to rob like a house or whatever it is, or business, doesn't want to confront any human being, doesn't want to get a confrontation. The robber doesn't mind the confrontation, the thief is trying to avoid the confrontation. So imagine a thief. Now, the way that in Talmudic times, this is how, if you were a thief, this is how you did it. So you dug a tunnel underneath the ground, underneath someone's home, right, from outside under the home, and then you popped up in the middle of the house. Okay? So the thief is digging this tunnel, and he's almost near the end, and right before he breaks through, what do you think he does? The Talmud says, "Ganva apumachtarta, rachmana karya." The ganav, the thief, right before he pops up, when he's still in the tunnel, right before he breaks through, what does he do? He davens to Hashem. He prays. He says, "What? Please, God, let there be no one there, you know, with a shotgun or whatever it is, right? Let there be no one there to encounter me. Let me be successful in my thievery." So look what's happening here. Let's read this inside. So take a look at this. This is again from the Talmud, a Talmudic quote, text number 6, Mike 207.
At the entrance to the tunnel, a thief
And when he says entrance, he means, like, in a sense, the exit, like where it comes up into the house. So the thief prays, trying to get in. Now, here is the opposite. What does it mean that the thief is praying? Who is the thief praying to?
God.
To God. So does the thief believe in God?
Yeah.
If the thief is praying to God, you would think that he believes in God. Does he believe in a God that listens to prayers? Sure. Does he believe in a God that can answer prayers? Does he believe in a God that he hopes will answer his prayers? This man is a believer, or a woman, right? This person, wow. This person is pious on the inside. Faith and trust and belief and prayer, all of the beautiful inner qualities of a tzaddik. What's happening on the outside? It's a thief. So this is the opposite. You have people that are acting pious, but on the inside, you know, they have their own motivation. Here's someone who on the inside, tzaddik. He's praying. He's davening. He probably prays with more intent than your average person. This guy is really praying. And yet on the outside, what's the behavior like? It's a violation of God's will. It's a violation of human, you know, of human property, etc. So here we have the opposite condition. Somebody who on the inside is pure, on the outside is doing something corrupt. So the Rebbe once spoke about this, and the Rebbe pointed out that it's easy to point fingers at the thief, at the thief of the Talmud, and say, come on, this guy, who does that? Who prays to God and then breaks the law, breaks God's will? You're praying to the God defying, that you're rebelling against. Like, what a contradiction! You know what we call this? Cognitive dissonance. It's like, or maybe I don't know if that works exactly in psychological terms, but it's kind of like compartmentalizing. Like, I believe, but I'm going to do this, and like don't confuse me with my actions or my faith. The Rebbe points out in text 7b and 209 that indeed all of us do many of us do the very same thing in a subtle way. Text 7b, and please read this one. 209, every person. Or is it 210? Sorry, the English is on 210.
Okay, I was
going to
read the
sorry about that.
Every person can find within him or herself a subtle parallel to the thief who prays before he steals. For example, though a businessman believes that God is the source of success, he may nevertheless get caught up in all kinds of schemes that distract him from Torah and divine service and from his set times for study. More specifically, when he does succeed in business and afterwards something isn't as it ought to be, he thinks of more schemes, etc. Meaning, even though God has helped him succeed financially and enabled him to turn materiality into spirituality by giving a tenth or a fifth or somewhere in between of his income to charity, and charity is the one mitzvah about which God says, try me, and God is reliable. Nevertheless, he resorts to schemes, etc. This is a paradox, like the thief praying before he steals.
Let me just jump in for a quick second, because it's a long text. So what the Rebbe says is, what is the thief doing? And how does that apply to you and I? What the thief is doing is saying, I believe in God, but I'm going to do my own thing. Like, I believe in God, I'm going to pray to God, but I'm stealing. So he says, in a subtle way, it's obviously not the same, right? The businessman is not breaking any laws, but in a subtle way, it's the same type of paradox or duality, right? You have the business person who's praying to God, believes that God is the source of success and wealth and parnassah and all the blessings, and at the same time is losing sleep over all the schemes and wheelings and dealings, and thinks that they're in control, he or she is in control of the wealth, even though they pray three times a day. They pray, Baruch Aleinu as Hashanah Zot. May God bless this year. May God bless, may God grant me a livelihood. Even though this person believes that God is in control, but when it comes to action, they're doing their own thing. They're doing their own thing. It's like the thief believes in God, but he's doing his own thing. He's stealing. The business person is not stealing, right? But he's still, or maybe he's stealing, but even if not, even if everything is kosher, The notion that I need to make money is in a subtle way saying God's not in control. Now, if it's just to make a vessel, which we've spoken about so many times in these classes, if it's just to make a vessel, that's one thing. But he's talking about someone who's scheming devices and schemes to make the money, and when it doesn't work out, they take it all on themselves. All of that is believing, but in practice, living in a way that doesn't express that belief. Here we have another example, and it's regarding Torah study.
This paradox can be present among Torah students as well. One may believe that the Torah is God's wisdom and will, yet when he succeeds in his studies, he takes glory for himself. The result of all this is that sometimes he distorts the meaning of a given concept to gain the upper hand in a Torah discussion. Furthermore, many people transgress halakha from time to time for the convenience of their Torah study. This is all the result of one's faith remaining abstract, like the thief who prays before he steals. Therefore, we need the influence of Moses, the faithful shepherd, who nurtures the faith, bringing it down to earth so that one's deeds actually align with it. This is accomplished only through deep contemplation in a personal way, so that the results are not superficial.
Thank you. So here we go. So the second example that he gives is a Torah scholar, a Torah student. The Torah student believes that it's God's Torah, and he says the blessing, or he or she says the blessing before studying Torah, no sin at Torah, that God is giving the Torah, etc. And yet, there's arrogance in Torah study. This person studies and feels good. Look at me, look at all the Torahs that I've studied. And literally look at me, give me honor, give me kavod, and will sometimes distort the Torah to gain an upper hand in an argument, just to be right and to be the scholar that's supreme of all the other scholars. And sometimes will bend halacha, Jewish law, because for some personal gain. The point is, here you have an example of somebody who on some level believes and knows, but in practice, they're not behaving the way they ought to be. And so what he says is, the way he phrased it, in the English it says it's because the faith remains abstract. I'll give you the language in the original is, the emunah, the faith, is in the level of makif. Makif means it's kind of, it could mean superficial, or surface, or transient, or external, or abstract, however you want to translate it. The point is, it's not integrated. It's not. He's not living by it. It's, I believe, and I know, and this and that. Still, I'm going to steal. It's like the thief, right? I know in God, I believe in God, I pray to God, and I'm going to steal. It's like the ganef, who goes over to the rabbi, the town ganef, back in the old country, the town thief, goes over to the rabbi one year before Yom Kippur and says, Rabbi, I feel terrible. I steal, that's what I do for a living, and it's eating me up inside, and Yom Kippur is coming, I need to ask for tshuva, I need to get a path for repentance for tshuva. And so the rabbi sits with him, spends a half an hour outlining a path of spiritual recovery. And then he leaves. A few hours later, the rabbi wishes to know the time. So he reaches into his jacket to pull out his pocket watch. And his pocket watch is missing. It's gone. He says, I know I had a pocket watch, and I met with Yankel the Ganef. I can't believe it, but I have to ask him. So he goes over to Yankel. He says, Yankel, did you by any chance take my pocket watch? He says, yeah. I have to confess. Yeah, I can't lie to a rabbi. He says, I don't understand. We just had a meeting about you doing tshuva. What's going on? He says, Rabbi, tshuva is tshuva, but business is business. So, right is what we believe. Business is business. By the way, it's not a joke. The line business is business is basically what the Rebbe is referring to in text 7b. Somebody said, I believe in God, I pray to God, I know that God's the source of all the money and everything, all the blessings. But you know what? Business is business. I got to do this, I got to do that, I can't do this, I can't study because I have to go to work. All of the excuses. Business is business, what are you going to do? The Rebbe says, what do you mean? If it's true, then it's true. If you're not living it, it means that on some level it's still theoretical. So the point is to move. Okay, so a person professes faith and professes belief, but it still might be theoretical. until it's lived. So what's the core idea? The core idea is to move something from the abstract to the concrete, from the theoretical to the practical, from the external to the internal. It's about internalizing our faith, our belief, our values, and actually implementing it in our lives. So now we can get back to this notion that we started with which was about New Year's resolutions and inspiration. And I don't mean, you know, any old New Year's resolution. I'm using that just as an example of a concept of being inspired. But let's talk about inspiration as a whole. Inspiration, we know, is the way it works is easy come, easy go. You get inspired, you get excited, maybe it's out of nowhere, and then soon thereafter, done, it's gone. There is a text from the Alter Rebbe in his Likutei Torah, which is a series of discourses on the Torah portions. It's known as the Chassidah Sheparsha. It's the Chassidic Torah portion. So there's a teaching of the Alter Rebbe. It's found in text 8. And in subsequent texts, 12a, 12b, 12c. But in text 8, in this text that we're quoting in text 8 and others, the Alter Rebbe talks about somebody who is inspired and who finds that the inspiration doesn't last. Somebody who prays and is into it, and then it doesn't last. They make commitments, spiritual commitments, and then it doesn't last. It fades. What's going on? Why does it fade? And how to fix that? And I want to summarize some of the text. We'll read maybe one or two inside. I want to give you the overview. What he says is like this. Anytime inspiration comes to you, anytime you get inspired, just the kind of out of nowhere, you just get inspired, it's a gift from God. God is lifting you up. But shortly after God lifts you up, this inspiration lifts you up, God lets go. The question is, did you do anything on your own to anchor yourself up there while you were up there? If you did, you'll hold on. If you didn't, you'll fall right back down to where you were before you got lifted up. Again, imagine you take a mountain climber. What's the big mountain? Mount Everest, right? Yeah? Okay. You take a mountain climber. And somehow, magically, I don't think you can get helicopters over to Mount Everest, right? You can't. It's too thin. The air is too thin. Yeah. But let's say you could. Or another mountain. You lift the climber up. Let's say halfway. You lift him up or her up. Airlift. Right? Then, boom. So the question is like this. Then you let go. The question is, while you were up there, did you take your equipment and anchor on? Or were you just enjoying the ride? It's a wave, right? Did you just enjoy the wave? Well, the wave crests and the wave crashes. That's the way it is. Inspiration is easy come, easy go. You got it easy, it'll go easy. It'll leave easy. You didn't work on the inspiration on the high, you don't have to work on the low either. It's going to happen. But if you anchor yourself, if you put in the work while the good times are rolling, then it will be sustainable. The Alter Rebbe advocates that anytime you're inspired, anytime you feel uplifted spiritually, you have to start doing the work. You can't just say, well, I feel good. I feel good about myself. I feel good about my spiritual connection. It's easy to go to Shul and Daven. It's easy to go and study Torah. It's easy to give tzedakah. What happens when it crashes? Then it's going to be hard to do all those things unless you put in the work and you study and you internalize and you get deepen your connection with these things. Not just do them because it feels good right now. Because it's Sunday, it's tomorrow or whatever, some tomorrow, it's not going to feel good anymore. It's about anchoring yourself when you're inspired, investing in the effort to make sure that when the crash comes, you'll still be anchored. From the inside out, you're going to be where you need to be. Let's read a text that speaks to this. Take a look at 12C. 12C is the Eitzah, is the advice. It begins, at least the Hebrew begins on page 217. I don't know where the English is, but... Is it 218? No, it's but for all of us, let's do it in English. Dan.
This is good advice from God, blessed be He. As soon as one experiences such an auspicious occasion, when one is endowed with divine inspiration to awaken him, he ought to immediately begin on his own to evoke an awakening from within as well, to overcome and transform the emotions of the animal's soul. This is the meaning of the verse, draw me, we will run after you. Namely, when you, God, draw me near with a divine awakening, then I will immediately run after you.
Continue, one more paragraph.
My master, my...
No, no, it's, but if one does not, you don't have it?
No.
You sure?
Yes.
I'll tell you what I have. But if one does not exert himself in toil to refine the animal soul, then even if his godly soul is awakened by heaven, the inspiration will not last. That's the way it is. You get inspired, huh? But if one does not put in the effort to refine his or her own animal soul, then even when the godly soul is awakened by heaven, that inspiration will not last. God, what God does is, God gives us a push, a nudge. But God expects us to follow that up with effort on our own, to anchor it, to own it, to internalize it. If we don't do that work, then as soon as God lets go, if we're picked up, we will be let go at some point. The question is, where are we holding? So, Mishcheni acharecha narutza means, when you draw me, God, when you pull me, I'm going to do the running. I'm not going to... It's like, okay, here's a way to think about it. It's a totally random example, but I just thought of it. You know in those airports that have those moving sidewalks? Are you with me?
Yes.
The question is, when you're on the moving sidewalk, are you walking or are you standing still? And I'll tell you why. Because if you're saying, I don't need to walk, I can stand still, what happens when it stops?
You fall.
Well...
You stop.
You're stopping. You're like, well, how come we're not moving anymore? Because the moving sidewalk stopped. Did you train yourself to walk on your own? Or are you relying on someone else to schlep you? If you're reliant on on someone else, on some other force, it's not going to last. And when it crashes, you crash, God forbid. But if we train ourselves to do the work, then even when we don't have that outside inspiration, even when the sun is not shining and the birds are not chirping and the rainbows are not rainbowing, even when that's not the case, we'll still be ready to do what needs to be done because we're used to doing what needs to be done. In other words, easy come, easy go. The thief has an easy faith. It doesn't demand anything. The thief says, God, help me while I steal. The faith is not a demanding faith. The faith, his faith, doesn't demand a change of behavior. The faith is, do whatever you want and pray to God and it's all good. That's not real faith. Real faith is what demands from us. It questions, what are you going to do about it because of the faith? Are you going to change something because of that? That's the effort that we put in. So again, let's forget about the thief for a second. Inspiration. The reason why resolutions fail is because we got inspired by Facebook, Instagram, media, friends, New Year's, the calendar. We got inspired to make a resolution. Were we ready to make the resolution? When we made the resolution, did we set ourselves up for success? Or we were just going to say, well, I'm inspired. I made the resolution. It's probably going to go. That doesn't work. What are you, a hope and a prayer? That's not going to help. You have to put it, you have to invest. If you invest, it's going to work. If you don't invest, it's not going to work. And so now we're able to come back all the way back to the story of Yaakov and Yosef. What happens? You can imagine that at that moment when Yaakov sees his son after 22 years, you can imagine that he is quite inspired. And not only inspired, he is emotional. And he is in love. Feeling love. And he is feeling intense awe and gratitude and all of these wonderful emotions simultaneously. He is being lifted up. What Yaakov teaches us is that in a moment of inspiration, what is the greatest thing that you and I can do? Ground it in practical spiritual service. Don't just ride high with the highs, but anchor it with something tangible and something practical. You're inspired. What are you going to do about it right now? You're overwhelmed. What are you going to do about it? So what does he do? He says, precisely at the moment that I meet my son, I am going to recite the Shema. And that Shema is going to be a Shema for the ages. It's going to be a Shema prayer that resonates throughout the millennia. How do I know this? Because what are we talking about tonight? Yaakov Shema heard around the world. We're talking about a Shema prayer that was recited 3,500 years ago. We're talking about it tonight because he chose that moment to be his Shema moment. Had he given his son a kiss? Normal. That's normal. How long would that kiss have lasted? But what if he would have been inspired? Then he would have gotten used to his son. You know, so welcome back. That moment of seeing someone after so long, overwhelming. But then you see him every day, perhaps. So then it wears off. But he anchored his emotion in Shema. And when you anchor it in something tangible, in a mitzvah, then it can last for eternity. So in other words, Yaakov was teaching us this notion that when we're inspired, we have to then translate something into action. Take a look at text 13a, and I think this will be our last text. 13a, David, please read this, 2:18. That's what I'm going with, final answer.
When Jacob saw his son Joseph as the king, his heart was filled with love.
Wait, no, that's 13b.
That's B.
13a.
Got it. My master, my grandfather, explained the statement of our sages that Jacob did not kiss Joseph because he was in the middle of reciting the Shema. When the righteous experience love, they attach themselves to the love of God and become one with God. This, then, is why he was reciting the Shema, as the Maharal writes. However, my grandfather expressed the idea slightly differently than the Maharal.
The truth is, we don't. The last part about the being different than Maharal, we'll leave the Maharal aside for tonight. We'll end with this. We'll end with what the Sfas Emma says, quoting his grandfather, who was known as the Chadush HaRim. So he quotes his grandfather. He says, why didn't he kiss his son, and why didn't he cry over his son? Because he was saying the Shema. Why, in all of the times he kissed the Shema, why did he choose that time to say Shema? Because when he was having an incredible uplifting experience, when he was having an inspirational moment, he grounded it and attached it to a tangible act of thanking God and loving God. That's what he did. Why? Because that's what internalizes the experience. Otherwise, it would have been just a moment that would have, he would have been very inspired, and it would have gone away. But because he said Shema, that Shema stands for eternity, and that Shema is a lesson for us. Again, the life lesson for us is simple. It's when we get inspired, don't get carried away with the moment. Think to yourself, I'm inspired now. What am I going to do about it right now? How am I going to ground it in action? I'm inspired. Wow, a great class, a great sermon, a beautiful sunrise, a sunset, whatever it is. What are you going to do about it? Don't just run away with the inspiration or let the inspiration run away with you, because it's going to pass. What are you going to do about it? Doing something about it is what makes it last, and it's what allows us to be anchored, to anchor ourselves in truth and in our values. At the end of the day, the goal is that our inside should be like our outside. The goal is that we should be inspired and translated into action. And those actions should feed further inspiration. May we be inspired like nobody's business. Or everyone's business. And may we always translate our inspiration into real, tangible, positive action. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies. You guys are so kind.